Good to be with you all. Just seeing how many of you listened. Just had my King James Bible rebound. You know, one nice thing about some of the digital things we have is you can have multiple translations right at your fingertips. And I was taught very early the wrong number of translations is one, and also probably anything over 10 or 15. But there are several good ones that John pointed out to us, so thank you. My topic this afternoon is not one that I relish. I've come to this meeting occasionally and thought the speaker was being set up a little bit. I don't think I was being set up too much, but it is a very passionate topic. But I accept it because I believe souls are at stake. And as we consider it and its underlying tow, there will be some who will hope that I will tack in a certain way. Others will hope that I will tack in the opposite direction. And I think it's quite possible that I will disappoint both to some extent. On your program, the title of this topic is Leading and Controlling. When you had consider a topic, at least when I consider a topic, such as this, I need to decide, is it an either or a both and? If there's a contradiction between the choices, then it has to be viewed as an either or. Because the law of non-contradiction states that A and not A can both be true if they contradict or are in opposing claims. Therefore, in the question, is God good or bad? I must choose the either-or approach because God cannot be both good and bad because good and bad contradict. If, however, the question is God good and sovereign? I'm not forced into an either-or because good and sovereign do not contradict. And he could be and, in fact, is both. Our topic of leading versus controlling is really about leadership. I'm going to address it in the family and I'm going to address it in the church. But as stated, the question really is, and I was given some insight into what was really being asked that you don't have on your program. The issue is really being asked is, what style of leadership is most effective? Should we lead by influence and example? Or should we lead by controlling? But must we choose? Are they mutually exclusive or can the answer be both? I think that is very important because if we approach this question in the wrong way, we will get a wrong answer. If we approach it as an either or when it's a both and, I'll get the wrong answer. If I approach it as a both and when it's an either or, I will get the wrong answer. Is the concept of leading through influence and example mutually exclusive with the concept of leading through control? I do not believe they are completely mutually exclusive. And I'll try to make my case. In farming with livestock, or even your pet at home, how do you lead? Well, sometimes the cattle will just follow you in. Other times they have to be driven in. Sometimes Fido will just follow you to his cage. Other times you have to catch him and put him in. So we can see it is not always an either-or proposition, but dependent upon the moment, the will, the mind of the animal. The Bible often calls us sheep. Other times it frequently calls us children. Sometimes sheep simply follow. That's optimum. That's nice. But they don't do that every time. Therefore, sometimes we can lead by showing the way, and maybe other times more is required. As parents, is it best to lead by example and influence or by control? Well, in a perfect world, example and influence. The problem is we don't live in a perfect world. And I don't care how cute your kids are, they're not perfect kids. Because their parents have flaws. To take a child and say, here's my example, now take it or leave it, do what you want. That would be, in many cases, parental malfeasance. And there's a lot of that going on today. But parenting simply by controlling would also be parental malfeasance. And the child wouldn't learn to think and make decisions on their own, which they're going to have to do when they're no longer under your roof. I didn't realize I said this so often to my sons. I guess I did. Shane, in one of his talks, recalled that one of the things he remembers me telling him more often than anything is, think, Shane, think. I do remember saying it, I just don't remember saying it as often as he remembers me saying it. But what I was trying to do, I guess, was say, you're going to be out pretty soon, and I'm not going to be there. You got to learn to think and make decisions. That's part of what parenting is about. Fortunately, they had a better mother than they had a father. I'm dead serious about that. Our job as parents is to show our children what is right by teaching and by example, but then to also show and teach them that if they choose what is wrong, there are consequences for those wrong choices, because that's what it's going to be in life. Consequences for our actions is a key parental lesson. It's a godly lesson. And it sometimes requires control. And that's a missing element of far, far too many homes and too many parent-child relationships. 1 Samuel chapter 3, verse 13, Eli. God says, I will judge his house forever because his sons made themselves vile and he did not restrain them. Okay, boys, you choose. But I'm not going to exert control over you. Now, there are passages that indicate he wished he had, maybe. But when the horse is out of the corral, sometimes it's pretty hard at that age. You go back and read 1 Samuel chapter 2, 3, and 4, and you'll see a really sad parenting experience. Influence without control won't work. But control without example and influence won't work either. And you've probably seen parents try to raise their children just with the iron fist and not showing them how to do it, not giving them any godly example, and then wondering why it didn't work. Well, that's a no-brainer as to why it didn't work. There are multiple styles of parenting. Sometimes parents are very protective. I had overprotective in my notes, but when you're overprotective, that's sometimes we would call that the helicopter parent or the hovering parent. They just hover over their child. They pick up their clothes, comb their hair, tie their shoes, keep their room clean, do their homework, doing them and their future mate absolutely no favor. Hang on, kids. That was the worst part. You should see some of the looks I just got. But we try to protect them from any disappointment, and sometimes we overprotect them and don't allow them to fail and learn the lessons that allowed us to learn. we send them a message. You can't do it on your own. You've got to have us there. You cannot and you should not shelter your child forever. Down at Unionville, it's out of business now, but there was a 15 probably years ago, there was a funeral home that when you went to the cemetery and you said your words and they were getting ready to put them down, they would release a couple of white doves. It was really kind of neat. They quit doing that. You know why? Those white doves had been bred in total captivity. And within 30 minutes of releasing them, somebody had lunch. They were totally ill-equipped to survive. There is the concept of permissive parenting. Meekly giving in to your child's whims, demands, and temper tantrums. You ever seen that in the grocery store? Ever seen it at church? We do anything to keep our child from being angry. Deep down, I guess we fear the loss of our child's love. In the meantime, I think we lose their respect. I want both. And they know they can play you. We seek peace and harmony at any price. You know, kids are born with a self-inclination. It's very selfish. I was born that way. You were born that way. Some of us are stuck there. But they simply often can't discern at some ages what is best for them. That's why they got parents. And if there are consequences in a permissive parenting style, the children can usually weasel out of them. And if you want to know how God feels about that, you read about Eli and his sons. Even go a little further and look at Samuel and his sons. And there is a controlling style of parenting. You make all the decisions. You believe you're doing what's best, but you have a deep need for control. So you try to control all the facets of your child's life. In discipline, you have the subtlety of Attila the Hun. Colossians chapter 3, verse 21, fathers, provoke not your children to anger, lest they become discouraged. New King James, don't embitter them. And you and I have probably seen controlling parents whose children, as soon as they could, flew the coop, not only physically, but emotionally and spiritually. But there's a fourth style of parenting. There's probably more than four, but the fourth style is what I will call the biblical style, which I believe the biblical style of parenting with our children is a blend of protective, permissive, and controlling. Protective in that we as parents want to keep them safe. Permissive in that we want to allow them to make some mistakes so they can learn from them. Controlling in the sense that some things are simply non-negotiable or should be non-negotiable with our children. At least while they're under our roof. And that there are consequences. Adam and Eve. God says, God was a permissive parent in that he said, this is what I want you to do, now you choose. But when they chose wrongly, were there consequences for it? God was a blend of letting them learn, but also teaching them there were consequences. Cain and Abel, free to choose how they were going to sacrifice. But certainly Cain and his actions toward his brother was taught that there were consequences. Almost every parent at some point gets frustrated with their children. I don't want to put words in your parents' mouth, and all your parents love you, but sometimes they don't know what to do with you, and they're not sure why they got you. Doesn't mean they don't love you. They get frustrated. But you know what? our children get frustrated with us. I think it is very possible, and we have several elders or people who have served as elders here this afternoon. I think it is very possible that every elder here has at times been frustrated and disappointed by some in their congregation. I won't say it's 100%. I will say I've never talked to one that was totally free of that. But I think it's also very equally possible that every member here has at times been frustrated and disappointed by the leadership in their congregation. We're a family, so it seems so logical that the principles that apply to our physical families can also apply and should apply to our spiritual families. I don't know how many years it's been, 10, 12, 15. I gave a talk here, was assigned to talk about hugging a porcupine. And that's exactly the way we often are. We want to come together, then we get close, and then we start sticking each other, so we pull apart. We repel. In the church, in spiritual matters, what is the best style of parenting? Well, you and I, we are all different. And so are our leaders. They're different. They're not like me, they're not like you, they're not like one another. They have their own personalities, they have their own styles. But followers are also different also. When you're raising your physical children, if you have more than one, do you treat all of those children exactly the same? Well, you need to be consistent, but you don't treat them all the same. One of them, you can look at them and they fall apart into tears. I'm sorry. Another one, it takes a 4x4. And then you still don't know if you've got their attention. We are different. Parents are different. Children are different. Elders are different. Members are different. And wise leaders, home or church, wise members, home or church, understand that. We need to allow, to some extent, our leaders to be adaptable in style. Not adaptable in doctrine, but adaptable in style, because they are different. Fitting the personalities of various ones in the congregation. Sheep, us, we members, also need to be adaptable to different styles of leadership. If we expect our leaders to consider our styles of responding, shouldn't we also be accepting of their differing styles of leadership? We members are not all the same. We don't react all of the same. And our leaders are not all of the same. I think that's one of the great beauties of the plurality of leadership. Now, our leaders have specific responsibilities outlined in Scripture, and this, I don't have time to go into what are all of the duties of our leaders, but I'll tick down a few of them. 1 Peter chapter 5, verses 1 through 4 is one of my favorite passages on this. They are to feed the flock. They are to look after and protect the flock. They are to do it of a ready or willing mind. They are not to do it as lords, but as examples. But Paul in Acts chapter 20, verse 28, when he was meeting with the elders from Ephesus, told them to watch for false teachers, to protect the flock. That sometimes requires some control. I think 1 Peter 5, 1 through 4 is one of the most grand articulations of church leadership. And one of the keys to effective leadership, both in the home and in the church, but in the church, is to understand not every congregation is going to double in size. We would love for that to happen, but it has never happened that all congregations double in size. And not every leader is going to be a Moses a Joshua or a Paul. Those are great leaders to emulate. But I think it's extremely important that we as members of the flock and our leaders have what is I would call two-way compassion. Our leaders need to be very tolerant of those that he serves. Because that's what Christian leadership is service. And they sometimes need to give people room to be themselves. I'm not talking about compromising the doctrine. I'm talking about room to be themselves, even though it might not be that leader's preference. Allow people to have their own styles. I'm not speaking of tolerating lies or sinfulness, but individual quirks, individual idiosyncrasies, individual strengths. If we're going to function together, we must be tolerant of those things. Peter, writing in that passage that I gave you, 1 Peter 5, said a leader in the church is to be absent of pride. Any sense of pride in a leader is not a godly leadership characteristic. In that passage, Peter talks about himself as being a fellow elder. He doesn't say an apostle. He's not flaunting anything. He's saying, I'm down in the, as John might say, I'm down in the weeds with you. But we're also told that he is to have the heart of a shepherd. To feed. ASV says to tend, to shepherd. Unless a man has the heart of a shepherd, he had best not be in the position of being a leader in the church. There are other ways to serve, but don't get into eldership unless you have a shepherd's heart. And that's needed not only in the church, it's needed in our homes. Because it just won't work. I have this line in my notes, and I don't know whether to use it, but here it comes. Never try to teach a pig to sing. You always waste your time and annoy the pig. What that means is some people are just not cut out for certain things. In Romans chapter 12, verse 8, it talks about leading as a gift, an ability. We can all get better at it, but we are not all natural at it. I think that's one of the reasons Paul, writing to Timothy, says they should not be novices. There's other reasons, but I think that's part of it. A shepherd's heart includes teaching and exhortation, but it also includes love and patience and tolerance and understanding. We are told in this passage in Peter, they are not to do it because they have to. They should do it because they are willing to do it. We in the flock, however, need to be a reason the man is able to shepherd the flock willingly rather than it be a great anguish. Not to do it for money. I don't think that's a real issue for us in our fellowship. I don't think it would be wrong to support an elder in certain situations, but we have tended not to do that. But that should not be his motivation. There's this attitude of meekness, not as being as a lord, but being as a humble example. One of the greatest leaders, I mentioned him, was Moses. He was called the meekest man. Verse 4 is very interesting. It's the ultimate reward for a good leader, that righteous crown in heaven. But the flock has a responsibility to their shepherds also. Just like children have a responsibility to their parents. And one of the most scoring ones is found in Hebrews chapter 13, verse 17. It's not the only place, but I find this to be one of the most pointed. Obey them that have the rule over you and submit yourselves, for they watch for your souls that they must give an account. They're responsible. Awesome challenge. But listen to this last. That they may do it with joy and not with grief, for that is unprofitable to you. Am I a joy for my elders to lead? Or am I one of those that requires high maintenance and a high amount of their time? Is membership a right or a privilege? I think it's a privilege. I think it's a privilege. We as members of the flock have a participatory responsibility. Ephesians chapter 4 verse 16. All fitly joined together. Luke 6:44 says every tree is known by its fruit. You know how frustrating it is for elders when they can't get people to teach? Or do whatever task. Now, we can't all do each task. I understand that. If I hear one frustration from elders, probably more than any, I don't know if it's their biggest frustration, I just hear it the most, is we just can't get teachers. And then people gripe about the teachers you get. Give me a break. Would I rather listen to somebody else? Absolutely. And the older I get, the more I feel that way. But do I feel a responsibility to do what I can? Absolutely. In 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 10, it says, let there be no divisions among you. One of our responsibilities as members is to promote unity, peace, and harmony. Not at compromising the doctrine. There are times when we need to stand up for what is doctrinally true. John touched a little bit on this yesterday afternoon, not in this same context, but in judging, is it wrong or is it just my preference? I got preferences coming out the gazoo. And most of you don't meet them all the time. None of you meet them all the time. But I don't even meet them all the time. To maintain purity of the flock, 1 Corinthians 5, you're familiar with the problem the Corinthians had when they had the sexually immoral man amongst them. 2 Timothy 2, 19 through 22, I won't turn to read it, but it says the same. And one of our responsibilities as members of the flock is to ease the load of our leaders. To encourage them. To thank them. Why? Because we always agree with them? I've never been a member of a congregation where I always agreed with my elders. Because some of the issues are judgment areas. And they don't always make the call I would make. But I'm thankful that they're willing to make the call. To make the call. Just a couple of, well, more than a couple, but I'll try to hold it brief. To our leaders, just some thoughts for you to consider. Keep a healthy balance. Don't forget what it was like when you were part of the flock. And things that frustrated you are probably going to be things that will frustrate the flock. As you lead, always remain a good follower because we're all really sheep. We all are being led by the Lord, I hope. Remain teachable. Read, learn, observe. Not only the scriptures, but people. Know your flock. Be ready to change if that's what's needed. If the style you're using isn't working and there is another scriptural style that would work better, change. Admit it when you're wrong. Those of you that have been parents very long know that one of the most powerful things you can do is when you make a mistake with your children to tell them that and admit it. They will have respect for you. Now, don't get carried away and do it too often. But I have apologized to both of my sons on occasions. Because I overreacted. I didn't handle it the way Donna would have. But stand firm if you know you're right. Leaders, don't underestimate, but do not overestimate your importance. You are invaluable. The Lord put you there for a reason. But you're still human. Delegate whenever you can, when it's appropriate. When the flock does well, tell them they do well. Just like you would a child as a good parent. You have a serious work to do, so keep a good sense of humor, especially about yourself. Because we're all so funny, and I don't mean comedic. We're just funny. We're weird. I don't understand you all of the time, and you don't understand me, but I don't understand me either. Learn to laugh at yourself when it's appropriate. If you want a perfect leader, you'll have to go back to the Son of God. And now to the flock, a few words. Remember Hebrews 13:17. Be a reason for your leaders rejoicing in you being part of the flock. Would your congregation be better if everyone was like you? Well, that's a pretty monotonous and nauseous thought for most of us. But what I mean by that is that everyone had your level of commitment, your level of cooperation, your level of humility, your level of participation, your level of willingness. Would your congregation be better or worse? I think that's a legitimate question. Pray often for your leaders. Thank them. And defend your leaders whenever possible. Nothing feels better than to know you've got people that have got your back. And if a false teaching comes in, they can look to you to support them as they have to convict the gainsayer. Try to imagine being in their shoes and carrying their burden. We can't do this, and I know it would be unbiblical. But having said that, I've often thought, what if everybody could be an elder for 2 years? And then you're not anymore. I think it would change a lot of members' thinking about the eldership and leadership. The flock needs to breathe, just like our children need to breathe. They need to learn how to think. Because you leaders aren't going to be there forever. When I first started coming up here frequently, you had 2 elders. They're both gone. They weren't going to be here forever. And I mean this with all love and humility. Some of you got frustrated with them. And this, I can speak of every congregation represented here. But there's times when, now that they're gone, I wonder, it's sure nice to be back, to have a certain person back once in a while. No, leading is not a monopoly of control. That doesn't get us where we want to be. It's about being a motivational example. But having said that, there are times when control is needed because sheep don't always do what they should do no matter how often they are told. I don't, you don't. They don't. In James chapter 4, as I wind this down, it says, from whence comes wars and fightings among you? Come they not from within? There are times when we need to have very heart-to-heart conversations as leaders with our flock and as the flock with our leaders. I think that is so right, done in the right context. But Jesus in Matthew 18 clearly says, if you have aught against your brother, you go and talk to them. And that goes both ways. But we also very much need to remember who the enemy is. And my enemy is not my elders. And I pray their enemy is not me. I pray that all of our enemy is Satan and the world. Are we as members perfect? Do we frustrate our leaders? Are our leaders perfect? Do they not sometimes frustrate us? But unless it's a doctrinal issue, and they can arise, let's work as hard as we can to be the one body and stand on the one truth. I've never been part of a perfect congregation, and neither of you. They don't exist. Good congregations, spiritual congregations, yes. I don't know who said it first, I don't care. Wouldn't the church be wonderful if it wasn't for all the people? Well, obviously that's not quite right, because the church is the people, isn't it? Many of our brothers and sisters throughout the world, even throughout these states of Iowa, Missouri, Kansas, wherever, are very small and very isolated. And they would give much to have the opportunities of fellowship that many of us simply take for granted. I was talking to a lady at the break that used to go to Phoenix, and she can't go there anymore because her family's not there anymore. There's a congregation in Phoenix, wonderful people. But they are hundreds of miles, in many cases, away from just the natural interaction fellowship that you and I take so much for granted. I admire that group so much for their steadfastness. And it makes me thankful for you and for your love. Undeserved in so many, many ways. One nice thing about having your physical parents grow to an old age, you sometimes get old enough to remember to go back and tell them thank you. Well, it's not only our physical parents that love to hear that. Our kids love to hear it when we tell them we're proud of them. Elders, deacons, so does the flock. We close our thoughts this afternoon. We extend the gospel invitation. This is a most beautiful body, represented in many congregations here this afternoon. And I know it's easy for me and for you to get caught up in the warts. And goodness knows we got plenty of them. But don't let the warts drown out the beauty of the body. If we can help anybody in any way, we invite you to come as we stand and as we sing.